Our third class, the title is Aruna's Threshing Floor. So we'll call upon Brother Jason to give his third class.
Thanks, Jeremy. Hi, everybody. Okay, that was probably kind of a weird way to start a class. Sorry. Good afternoon, everyone. There, all right. Welcome to class number three. So, here we are talking about Aruna's threshing floor. Now, we're just going to look at the story. We're going to talk about the location. And then we're going to talk about a psalm that I think was written about this time. And that, I hope, will kind of bring it all together for us. Now, we've been looking at our lessons about true faith and how true faith focuses on the salvation of others, how it perseveres. And what we're going to see in this class is that true faith gives everything. We're going to see it with David, that not only is he willing to give his money and his possessions, but he's also willing to even give himself. So true faith gives everything. There's still more why questions, so it's still, again, TBD. You know, eventually we'll get rid of this TBD and I'll have one question up there, but there's still a lot of things to ask. So God had said that the terror would last for days, that there was going to be this plague that was going to last for a long time, but then it stops. Why? Why does that happen? Why does it stop even though God had said that it would last for a long time? And even more, why does he stop the plague with this method? Doesn't it seem rather odd? Maybe I should say oddly specific, right? You must offer a sacrifice by building an altar at a threshing floor. Now keep in mind, how old was David at this point? Yeah, it's 69, almost 70-ish, right? And he's supposed to build an altar on the top of Mount Moriah and offer all these things. That's a high call, right? This is a big thing. Why? Why was this specifically what God wanted him to do? Not only that, do you notice it wasn't just go find some threshing floor and do it, but it was go find the threshing floor that belongs to Aruna, and God specifies Aruna the Jebusite. Why does he do that? Why does he name him as a Jebusite? Why does it have to be a Jebusite's threshing floor? Well, let's just quickly review the story. So first of all, lives get saved because one man acts, because David acts, and because God provides a way of escape. He's supposed to set up an altar in the threshing floor of a Jebusite. And here's the quick summation. Maybe it's reverence, maybe it's fear, we don't really know. But something causes Aruna, or Ornan, if you're reading 1 Chronicles 21, something causes him to say, you can have everything. Whatever it is that you need, I'll give it to you. So he tries to provide all of the sacrifice, all the wood, everything for the altar. He tries to provide it to David. Now, what does David say? He says, uh-uh, I won't take it. Right? Because David knows this is supposed to be principles of sacrifice. It's not a sacrifice if somebody else gives it to you. So David says, no. Instead, God doesn't want somebody else's thing. Sacrifice is supposed to cost something. We have to give everything. And that's really the theme that comes out, I think, of this section. That David is now going to give everything. And in fact, Aruna himself is also going to be willing to give everything. So, this is all about sacrifice. It's all about how much are we willing to give. So here's how it works. King said unto Aruna, nay, but I will surely buy it of thee at a price. He refuses, as we said, neither will I offer burnt offerings unto the Lord my God of that which doth cost me nothing. So David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. Okay. Now, in Chronicles, David pays a whole lot more, 600 shekels. And it's not silver, it's gold in Chronicles. That's a huge amount more. Now, that's a pretty massive discrepancy, and people have kind of wondered. My theory, so this is my thought, and it might be totally wrong, but I wanted to make sure you knew that it could be totally wrong. That's why I said that. Okay, my theory is, I think Ornan in Chronicles, or Aruna, owned the entire mountain. And in Chronicles, David buys the whole mount. And here, he's just talking about the threshing floor. which is why it says, so David bought the threshing floor and the oxen for 50 shekels of silver. So I think Samuel's talking about the threshing floor. Chronicles is talking about the whole place. Okay. Now, what's interesting about this is, let's just step back and think about what was going on in this entire situation. David had just asked the people for how much? $6, right? And they refused. 70,000 people refused. Here's David now giving 600 shekels of gold. I think we should feel that contrast as we read this. There's that background of, this is all about the half shekel that the people didn't pay. And here's David willing to give so much more. Now, I think it's purposefully meant to be a contrast. Especially because when you look in Exodus, do you notice what the half shekel is called? It's called the offering of the Lord. Isn't that interesting that David is told to make an offering? So this is the contrast of what, here's what they should have done, and now David is showing this example of, no, it's not just about a half shekel. You should be willing to give this much. It's about giving everything. David could have done the whole sacrifice for free, but that's not the point. He purposefully gives 600 shekels of gold, contrasting with the people who could have paid or who wanted to pay nothing. So you get a burnt offering, total dedication, giving everything, right? Which leads to a peace offering, which is fellowship with God. And that's the principle. Total dedication leads to fellowship with God. So I think that's what we're being shown here. This wasn't just some kind of random thing where God said, you know, do all these things, and if you follow them exactly correctly, then I'll know that you're obedient, and I'll stop the plague. But it was really God saying, look, this is how reconciliation happens, right? I need to see. This is all about the people not giving. It's all about the people not being devoted, and he needed David to show that devotion, to show an example to the people. Okay, so that's what he requires. And so everything stops when David does that. And that's where David knows the site of the future temple. Now, I think there's more to the story. So that's just the story, but now we're going to unpack it a little bit. Let's talk about a troubling connection. Now, here's what that connection is. David is told, again, sounds kind of random to us, but it wasn't. I think it was totally purposeful. He's told, go to the threshing floor of Arunah the Jebusite. Now, there's one other time when David was at a threshing floor in Scripture. Anyone know when it was? It was when David brought the ark to Jerusalem. When Uzzah touches the ark, Uzzah dies at a threshing floor. So how do you think David felt about threshing floors? Right? This was probably not, you know, a super good association. It's that time where you can almost imagine David hearing this, go to the threshing floor of a room and thinking, ah, a threshing floor? Like, I gotta go to one of those again? You know, but I gotta remember what happened last time. But it's not just that. So God gives very specific directions, and I think he does that because God is actually reminding David of all of this. A threshing floor shows up one other time. It's right here, 1 Chronicles 13:8-9. Says, David and all Israel played before God with all their might, with singing, with harps, with psalteries, with timbrels, with cymbals, and with trumpets. When they came unto the threshing floor of Chidon, Uzzah put forth his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled. So there they are at the threshing floor. That's the other time. But it's not just those instances or those connections. Because in 1 Samuel 24, verse 1, it says, the anger of God was kindled, and it wasn't against David. And do you remember what we read about God's anger in the story about Uzzah? It says in 2 Samuel 6, verse 7, that the anger of Yahweh was kindled, and not against David, but against Uzzah. 2 Samuel 24, by the way, that's another instance that I think we sometimes misunderstand. We talk about all the bad things David did. It never says that God was angry with David about it. He was angry with Uzzah. 2 Samuel 24:17 says that the offenders were smitten by God, right? Plague happens on the people of Israel, the 70,000. 2 Samuel 6:7, Uzzah gets smitten by God. Same thing. 2 Samuel 24:17, David is displeased or feels guilty about what's happening. You know, he says, the sin is mine. These people are sheep. Right? David doesn't want this to happen to the people. Same thing that David feels when Uzzah is struck. He's displeased with the situation. 2 Samuel 24:18, the ark then finds a home in a Gentile's property. Now, I know that's controversial. Just by the way, I know some people think that Obed-Edom was a Levite. I don't think that. We have time for me to tell you why. So, Obed-Edom is called Obed-Edom the Gittite, right? Gittite is the word Giti in Hebrew. Every single time it's used, it refers to a Philistine. Except for this one, if you think Obed-Edom is a Levite. Now, if you think that, that's okay. I recognize that there are reasons for thinking that, okay? I can acknowledge that, and I can see why it's controversial. I still think I'm right, but you know, maybe you're right, and that's okay, right? We'll still be friends, I hope, as long as you'll have me. So the point here, though, is I think you can see the parallel if Obed-Edom is a Gittite, if he is from Gath, and that is that the ark found a home in a Gentile's property, and the same thing is going to happen again. Why do you think David suddenly offers the offering and says, I figured it out. Here's where the temple's going to go. I think because David is putting all this stuff together. It's the threshing floor. It's the place of a Gentile, right? And he's realizing, this is what I've been waiting for this whole time. God is actually redoing this scenario to show David where the ark is supposed to go. So, however, before David figures that out, I think the connection would have freaked him out. Right, initially, it would be like, oh, a threshing floor, I got to go there. Like, you know, I remember what happened last time. Yet David perseveres. So he goes to the threshing floor. Now, the question becomes, well, why a threshing floor? Aside from the connection with Uzzah. Maybe that was it. Maybe David was just supposed to think about those connections. But I think in addition to that, what's the whole idea behind threshing? I'm not a farmer. I'll say that. I'm a professor, I'm a teacher, like I don't ever touch farming. So if I say anything wrong about farming, I apologize. But threshing, from what I have read, this is what threshing is for. Any ideas? It's separating wheat from the chaff, right? So you throw your, whatever they're called, I don't even know, wheat kernels or something. You throw those up, right? And it's windy, and the good stuff goes down, the bad stuff flows away. Okay, so you can see with my, you know, highly academic terminology, how confident I am about what all that is. But anyway, the point is that it separates things, right? That's the idea behind threshing floors. Okay, well, he's also told to go to a threshing floor that is outside of the city that's owned by a Gentile. Now, a threshing floor, as I said, is wheat from the chaff, grain is crushed, then it's winnowed. Okay, that process is often associated scripturally with judgment, right? God often talks about threshing nations. And so the idea behind that, you see it in Jeremiah 51:33, it's time to thresh her. That's about Babylon. Threshing Babylon. Habakkuk 3:12, thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. So this threshing is this idea of judgment, right? That the chaff gets blown away by the wind, right? Psalm 1. And the wheat stays. So threshing is often connected with judgment. So the fact that God says, go to a threshing floor, I would suggest to you is God is judging Israel. And that fits, right, with what we see. Israel didn't want to pay the half shekel, so God is going to judge the people. Okay, there you go. Psalm 1:4, like the chaff, Isaiah 17:12-13, the wicked are like the chaff of the mountains before the wind. Okay, so maybe that's why David was supposed to go to a threshing floor, because God is threshing Israel. I think that fits. God is threshing Israel, and they come up wanting. They've been judged. It's not working. Now, that, though, is where I think this is very powerful. Because David, then, would be the wheat. Israel becomes the chaff. David's the wheat. Here's the one who's offering 600 talents of or shekels of gold. But not only is it David, I think we should also spend some time focusing on Aruna. Because I think he's also set up as a contrast to Israel. So the point is that on the top of this mountain, you have these two men who contrast so strongly with Israel that it is a rebuke to the people. This is what they should have done. Because the record doesn't just focus on David. It also focuses on Aruna. So let's talk about him. So he's supposed to go to the threshing floor of a Jebusite. Now, let's just do a quick brain dump. What do we know about Jebusites? What are some of the things? Who are they? They're the original inhabitants of Jerusalem. Okay, good. Anything else? How? What was their attitude when David tried to take over the city originally? They laugh at him, right? They say, you know, even if the blind and the lame were here, you couldn't get into this place. So they're making fun of David. So this is who they are. They're also one of the nations that God says would be a thorn in Israel's side. They get left. So they're part of the nations that God says he'll cut off in Exodus 23:23. And the same thing is said over and over and over. People didn't drive them out, Judges 1:21. So God leaves them as a thorn in Israel's side, Judges 3 verses 4 and 5. So this is the situation. They then unite with Israel's enemies to fight against Israel. And they then make fun of David with the whole blind and the lame thing. Okay. So that's what we get as far as Aruna's ancestors, which I think really just emphasizes to us that what he says is all the more amazing. Because when he has that background, it's very much set up that he's going to have this kind of hostility against David, right? But he doesn't. Instead, David comes up and Aruna says, what do you need? Because that's the idea behind this section. That's the point. So he comes, Aruna looked and saw the king and his servants coming on towards him. Aruna went out and bowed himself before the king on his face upon the ground. Aruna said, wherefore is my lord the king come to his servant? David said, to buy the threshing floor of thee, to build an altar unto the Lord, that the plague may be stayed from the people. And Aruna said unto David, let my lord the king take up and offer whatever seemeth good unto him. Behold, here be oxen for burnt sacrifice, threshing instruments, other instruments of the oxen for wood. Now, remember, this was a totally surprise visit, right? I don't know about you. I really don't like surprises. So please don't ever, like, throw me a surprise birthday party or something. I'd probably, like, cry and run away. So, like, that... Aruna is just hanging out. What's he doing? He's threshing wheat, right? He's just like getting stuff ready, you know, for the night. And all of a sudden, David comes up and he's like, people are dying. I gotta build this altar, do these things. And Aruna doesn't say like, okay, yeah, you know, have at it. He says, what do you need? Right? He just drops everything he's doing. He says, I got oxen. I got wood. We can do all this, whatever it is. Not only that, but take a look at this. 2 Samuel 24:23 says, all these things did Aruna as a king give unto the king. Just note that, by the way. As a king. In other words, who was this guy? You know, was he like the former Jebusite king or something like that? Now, that's what the King James says. In case you're wondering about that whole point, the Hebrew actually says, Aruna the king, give unto the king. So it calls him Aruna the king. All these things that Aruna the king, give unto the king. And Aruna said unto the king, the Lord thy God accept thee. That's what a Jebusite said to him, right? May God accept your sacrifice. Okay, now, one thing that I want to bring out is what's underlined here in this yellow. All these things. The Hebrew here is the word hakol, which generally is translated as everything. And I think you can see that point coming out again. It's not all these things that he gave. It's everything. Where do you think he got the wood? Did he just happen to have wood like hanging out in his threshing floor? Like, I mean, in my mind, like, I think what we're being shown is here's a guy using, what, like a pitchfork or something to thresh? And he says, you need wood? Here, use my tools. Like, you know, whatever we have around. Anything he's got, because people are dying. He's like throwing in his livelihood here. He's giving everything. Okay, I think we often misread this. A lot of people say, oh, you know, this is Middle Eastern bargaining. It's like, oh, I'll give you everything. Not really, you know, right? Like, I don't think that's what's going on here. Because he calls himself David's servant. That's a big contrast. He's a Aruna the king, right? And yet here he is, and he says, my lord the king, what do you need? Can you just feel the tension with what Israel was doing? He says, what do you need? I'll give it to you. Anything I have, right? However we're going to get the wood, we're going to make that altar here on the top. Like, let's do it. And Israel wouldn't pay $6 to help support the temple. And I think that's what the threshing floor is all about. That's why it's a threshing floor. That's why it's Arunas. That's why it's the threshing floor of a Jebusite. Because we're supposed to see, here's this guy that has all the odds stacked up against him. You look at his background, you look at the fact that he's the king of the Jebusites, and you say, no way, he's going to help. And all of a sudden you read, and he gave everything. It could be fear. But I think it's not. And here's why. This structure, is anybody here into chiasms? Oh yeah, chiasms are exciting. Okay, so here's what chiasms are. So chiasms are literary structures in which you have one point that comes out and it's matched again later. And then another point that's matched right before that later point. We call it like ABC and then CBA. Right? So the A's match, the B's match, and then you have a C like in the middle. So let me show you this one. This is the chiastic structure of this section. So verse 21 says, David said, I've come to buy the threshing floor, to build an altar unto the Lord, that the plague may be stayed from the people. That matches with verses 24 and 25. David bought the threshing floor, David built an altar, and the plague was stayed with Israel, from Israel. Right? Same thing. Buy the threshing floor, build an altar, plague stayed. Bought the threshing floor, built an altar, plague stayed. So those are your two A's. Verse 22 is, let my lord the king take and offer up whatever seems good to him. Verse 24 is David saying, no, I'm going to buy it at a price. Right? So you have the back and forth. Take whatever you want. No, I'm going to buy it. Those are your two B's. What's in the middle? All these things that Aruna as a king give unto the king. And Aruna said unto the Lord thy God, said unto the king, the Lord thy God accept thee. The point of a chiasm is not just to, you know, have cool colors or like some kind of structure or something like that. It's not a memory thing. The point of a chiasm is, it's like putting exclamation points on the middle section. What you're supposed to see as you read through this is you're supposed to be reading, 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 and then all of a sudden, boom, here's Aruna. Here's his sacrifice. This is the highlighted section of the story. Here's what he's giving. So it could be fear. That's a possibility. But I think what the structure of the story is trying to show us is it's trying to show us a contrast with here's the 70,000 who won't give $6, and here's a Gentile who's giving everything. It's the focal point. God is threshing Israel. Now, he isn't just a contrast to Israel, because, as I said, when David comes and meets him, he's threshing. Now, who else was threshing? This is about God threshing, right? God is the one who's judging Israel. So it's interesting that Aruna is actually also the one who's threshing wheat when David shows up. Now, Jebusite, anybody know what Jebusite means? Jebusite means thresher. So, I think we have an emphasis here, and this then presents an even stronger contrast. Now, I hope we can really feel it, that here's the story in which you have Israel not paying $6, and you have a Gentile who gives everything, and God says, oh, and by the way, I'm threshing, and so is he. God is actually identifying, not with one of the Israelites, but identifying with a Gentile. Can you imagine how that would feel to one of the Israelites? Greater faith I've not found in all Israel? Perhaps. And so maybe that's why David had to go outside the city to find the threshing floor. That's why he couldn't just do any old threshing floor. But God specifically says, go to the threshing floor of Araunah, which at that time was outside the city gates. Everything that's sacrificed comes from a Gentile. But wasn't that the whole idea? This was supposed to be the house of prayer for all nations. Do you see it all just coming together for David? This is why David gets up at the end and says, I found it. This is the spot. Now, this had been on David's mind for a long time, this whole idea. Because David had actually been working with the Gentiles. Now, if you think about this and you say, what? How could a Jebusite king, you know, be acting like this? Well, this wasn't just random. David had been thinking about the Gentiles for years and years and years. So David had had a tabernacle. You remember the story of his tabernacle? This is like one of my favorites. So we'll do a quick discursus here. Okay. In Acts chapter 15, this is the story of the Jerusalem conference. And I feel like this is one of the most fascinating stories because it doesn't go the way you would expect it to. So Jerusalem conference, the big thing they're talking about is, should the Gentiles be circumcised, right? That's their big question. Should Gentiles be circumcised? Should they keep the law of Moses? Now, Peter gets up, and Peter says, look at all the amazing things that happened when I went and preached to Cornelius, right? The Spirit fell on them. We could clearly see God working. Now, if you heard that, and if you had seen things like that, you would probably say, yeah, Peter, you're right, right? Everybody hears it, and they're like, oh, yeah, okay. Like, nobody does anything after Peter says that. And so after that, Paul gets up, right? And Paul gets up at the Jerusalem conference, and he says, look, all kinds of things have happened. I preached to the Gentiles, wonderful things. The Gentiles are getting the Spirit. Like, it's great. And what does everybody do? Nothing. They're just like, okay, yeah, that's good. Okay, Peter, thank you. Paul, yeah, good. They don't do anything. And so James stands up, and James says this. Simeon hath declared how God at the first did visit the Gentiles, to take out of them a people for his name. To this agree the words of the prophets, as it is written, after this I will return, I will build again the tabernacle of David which has fallen down, I will build again the ruins thereof, and I will set it up, that the residue of men might seek after the Lord, and all the Gentiles, upon whom my name is called, saith the Lord, who doeth all these things. Now, this is the mic drop. Like, James gets up, says this, and everybody's like, yep, he's right, the end. And the conference is done. What is it about that, right? Like, this is an obscure verse from Amos 9. What is it about that that causes everybody to say, well, Peter's testimony didn't convince me, and Paul's testimony didn't, but you just quoted that random verse from Amos 9, and now I'm completely convinced. Why? And that's because people back then knew what David's tabernacle was. Now, let's talk about it. So when David brings the ark to Jerusalem, it's 1 Chronicles 16. When David brings the ark to Jerusalem, he sets up a new tent, right? Oh, I've departed my slides here. I got too excited. Okay, that's all right. We'll skip that part. Okay, it's 1 Chronicles 16. David sets up a tent for the ark. And this is a whole fascinating story. I actually have seven classes on this, so we won't. We're not going to go into too much right now, but it's really cool. I'll say this. If you ever get the chance, take a look at what the ark was doing and what it would have been like on the Day of Atonement before David made this tent. All right, that's it. That's all that we're going to do as far as that goes. But it's really interesting. Check it out. Okay, so David makes this tent, and he pitches it in Jerusalem. He puts the ark there, and what he does is he sets up a new center of worship. Now, this is crazy because what it means is, in Gibeah, the original tabernacle is still there. That has the laver, has the altar, has the lampstand, all that stuff. And at David's tabernacle, all you have is an altar. And the only way we know that is because he sets up people to offer offerings. So presumably, they do that on an altar. Now, my point in saying all this is David's tabernacle is a system of worship that has significantly less rituals involved. It has offerings, but it doesn't have washing, doesn't have any of the bread of the presence, doesn't have the lighting of the lamps, none of those things. It just has offerings. And guess who were invited to go there? The Gentiles. So in 1 Chronicles 16, 24 to 26, this is its inaugural ceremony. And David has Asaph sing a song all about how the Gentiles should come and worship there. All you nations, praise Yahweh, he says. The Gentiles were supposed to come to this tent, and Jews too. You know, he wasn't trying to have like two ethnic forms of worship. That would be very strange. So that was not his intention. It was a place for Jews and Gentiles to come together that didn't have all of the pieces of the law. Now do you see why James's comment was so strong? James gets up and he says, everybody, God said the tabernacle of David would happen again. And that's now. And so everybody says, oh, Gentiles can come in and they don't have to follow the law. Right? Because that's what David had done. Now, if you've ever wondered too, do you remember at the Jerusalem conference, they send like this funny little list of refrain from adultery, refrain from things strangled, and from blood, right? Like these kind of things that we look at and we're kind of like, huh, that's interesting. Well, that's just like David's tabernacle, right? He still had an altar. There were still pieces of the law that were involved. And so in Acts 15, they do the same thing. Okay, the point of all of this is that's where Aruna comes from. Aruna, Ittai the Gittite, Uriah the Hittite, all of these faithful Gentiles come from this tabernacle in the middle of Jerusalem where David invites them to worship. And that is why when David conducts his census, there's 153,000 Gentiles who come to help build the tabernacle. That was a good preaching effort. I would also think it was probably a preaching effort that would have been very hard to enact. Because can you imagine the opposition initially? I'm going to bring Gentiles here. They're going to worship in front of the ark, and they're not going to be circumcised. Right? Can you imagine the... Ooh. But David does it, and God's happy with it. Now, Aruna gives everything, as it says there. But I think David becomes the example of really giving everything in this story. So Aruna becomes a contrast with Israel, but so is David. He gives of his wealth, he gives of his time, but even more than that, he's actually going to give even when he doesn't have anything left to give. So I want us to take a look at this. This comes out in one of the Psalms. It comes out in Psalm 30. This is what the city of David would have looked like at the time. This is David's palace, which is really cool. If you ever get the chance to go to Israel, by the way, it just came out in 2006. Archaeologists believe they found David's palace. So anyway, that's a whole other thing we can talk about. I have a class on that too. The psalm tells us when it was written. So if you look at the title, here's what it says. At the dedication of the house of David. Now, to me, that doesn't make a ton of sense. Like, there is no big, exciting David building a house kind of thing in Scripture. And if you look at it in the Hebrew, we can actually retranslate this a little bit. So here's what it says in Hebrew. This is Mizmor Shir, Hanukat, Habayit La David. This is actually a word Hanukkah, by the way, Hanukat, which is dedication. So Mizmor Shir is a song of dedication, is what this is saying. The house to David. So the question is, really, what do you do with this here? This to David, or of David? Well, you could translate it as the dedication of the house of David, which is what the KJV does. Or you could translate it like this. Here's the Hensley Dynamic Translation. A song at the dedication of the house of David. In other words, David wrote this. Now, it might just look like a period change, but I think it's a little more than that. There's more going on here. Look at that letter. That's called a lamed, and that letter is actually a whole word in Hebrew. It's your word of, or to, or for. It's one of those funny words that can be three things. The reason that that is significant is because in the Psalms, it always denotes authorship. So Psalm 45 has that there, and it gets translated as of the sons of Korah. Psalm 45 is a psalm of the sons of Korah. It's not the sons of Korah possessing something. In the Psalms, that prefix means that they wrote the psalm. Maskil of Asaph, there's your lamed again. Asaph wrote this maskil. Psalm 88, title, of Heman the Ezrahite, there's your lamed. So in other words, when we see that, it's not telling us that it's the house of David. It's telling us that the psalm is of David, not the house. It's a psalm that David wrote when he dedicated the house, and it's of David. That's also just not the right construction anyway. Hebrew uses something called the construct state that would make more sense. So it's David's psalm, and you'll just see this in all the psalms that David writes, the same form. Okay, therefore, this is why most newer translations translate it that way. Psalm of David, it's a song at the dedication of the temple. Or the dedication of the house. The temple, the house. Because David never saw the dedication of the temple, right? Except in this story. When he proclaims, this is the house. So I think this is a psalm that David wrote just after all of this. This is the house of the Lord God. This is the altar of the burnt offering for Israel. This is the dedication of the house. So, let's put the pieces together. Let's take a look at the psalm's details and see how it fits. So Psalm 30, verse 1, take a look at this. David says, "You have not made my foes to rejoice over me." Now, what foes did David have at this point? Basically, like, everybody, right? Like, it was Absalom's rebellion, Sheba's rebellion, Joab, and now there was going to be another rebellion after that, right? So that fits pretty good. You got a lot of rebellions going on. Psalm 30, verse 4 says, "Give thanks at the remembrance." Now, that word remembrance is your word zecher in Hebrew. There's your Strong's number, 2143. And, interestingly, that half shekel in Exodus 30, verse 16 is called a memorial. And that word memorial is zacharon. These are very strongly related words in the Hebrew. They're not the exact same, but they're very, very similar. Psalm 30, verse 5 talks about how God's anger endures for a moment. Isn't that what happened? Psalm 30, verse 5 again. Yours for a moment, the plague is cut short. Psalm 30, verse 5 again, in his favor is life. That word favor is the word that Aruna uses. It's ratzon. When Aruna says, may the Lord thy God accept thee, it's the word accept. Psalm 30, verse 7. You made my mountain to stand strong. Isn't that what this is about? Mount Moriah? That's where this happens. Made my mountain stand strong. 2 Chronicles 3, verse 1. That's where we read about it being Mount Moriah. Psalm 30, verse 11 says, you put off my sackcloth. Anybody want to guess what David was wearing? He was wearing sackcloth. 1 Chronicles 21, 16. So this is the historical context. Now, the reason that this is so significant, so we can say, okay, the psalm was written when David was doing this whole thing, staying the plague, trying to make this altar with Aruna, all of that. Well, the reason that it's significant is because Psalm 30 is all about somebody who is so sick that they're about to die. Psalm 30, verse 1, David's enemies were going to rejoice when he was dead, is what it says. It says, I was about to die, and my enemies were going to rejoice, and you prevented them from it. Psalm 30, verses 2, 8, and 10 talk about David crying to God and God giving him life again. Psalm 30, verse 3 speaks as though death is certain. And verse 9 says that he's going to die in the midst of attempting to serve God. The reason that Psalm 30 is so crucial to us is it shows us that not only was David dealing with the people and Joab, David was actually dying at this point. Now, that fits, by the way. Samuel and Chronicles don't mention that, but if you keep reading in the Kings account, right, the very next chapter is 1 Kings 1, and you remember what happens there? Now, King David was old and stricken in years, and they covered him with clothes, but he got no heat. Right, this is David at the end of his life. He was sick and he couldn't get out of bed. Bathsheba goes in, and again it tells us, and the king was very old. So, here's another piece to add on. Here's David, he can't get out of bed. The prophet comes to him and says, David, the way to stop this plague, people are dying, here's what you got to do. You got to go climb up the mountain. Don't forget to bring your materials to build an altar. And offer there on the top of the mountain, that'll make the plague stop. And can you imagine David looking at Nathan and saying, Nathan, I can't get out of bed. Like, what am I supposed to do? How do you expect me to do this? Let alone climb up a mountain. In 1 Chronicles 28, verses 1 and 2, it's Solomon's second anointing by David. This is very, very close to the end of David's life. That anointing emphasizes something. What it emphasizes is the fact that David stood up. It says the king stood on his feet. Because that was the situation that David was in at the time. Now, what's interesting about that is David seems to write Psalm 71 at that time. And what he says is that he knows that God will quicken him again. Again? Well, when had that happened before? And I think it's here. I think David says, you're going to do it again because you did it to me this time. That was the only way I could get out of bed, climb up that mountain, and offer this offering. Now, has anybody done that walk, by the way? City of David up to the Temple Mount? I found it hard, and I was 31 when I did it. I was winded. Now, what's interesting about the psalm is I think the psalm alludes to this too. The recovery is not just half-hearted. This is where David says, you have turned my mourning into dancing. This is the kind of recovery that David had. God says, David, you still got work to do. Here's what's going to happen. And I think God gave David strength to do it. So not only then does David give of his material wealth, but even his physical well-being. He's there, bedridden, and he says, okay, that's what I need to do. I don't know how I'm going to do it, but I'm going to try. And I think God gives him the strength to do it. Now, that's very powerful, I think, for us. I think God often gives us the ability to do more than what we ever thought we could. God helps us conquer our anxieties. He helps us conquer things physically we didn't think we could do. He helps us conquer moments where our faith is failing. And that's really what we see here. But what he's looking for from us is to see, are we actually willing to give everything? Are we willing to push a little harder? Are we willing to go so far to say, this makes me uncomfortable and I don't know how this is going to turn out, but this is what you want me to do, so I'm going to do it. True faith focuses on the salvation of others, it perseveres, and ultimately, it's willing to give everything.